This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here we are 5 years after the crisis. We're going to be okay, aren't we?
I'm not saying we're going to be okay.
Hank Paulson coming up, and you got to figure he knows, huh? From American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Friday, the 13th of September. Good as always to have you with us. My talk with former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson a little bit later on in the broadcast, but we will begin this Friday with 4 minutes of live radio, the week in review, our weekly wrap, we like to call it. For that, we've got The Guardian's Heidi Moore and John Carney from CNBC. They're at Marketplace East, our bureau in New York City. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So our tagline this week, you guys, has been the legacy of Lehman Brothers as we think about the 5 years gone by. And Heidi, let me go to you first and ask you, what, in your considered opinion, is the legacy of Lehman Brothers?
I think it really changed Wall Street the way that we know it. Wall Street used to be kind of this area of broad shoulders. Now those shoulders are slumped. And you know, a lot of people talk about how Wall Street has worked against regulation, and that is absolutely true. Mm-hmm. Dodd-Frank is not a strong law. But the truth is that it's not just Congress that doesn't know what Wall Street needs to look like. It's also Wall Street itself. They're just in a zombie state. They're feeling themselves way through this new world where they're just a pastiche of businesses that were cobbled together by bailouts and acquisitions, and they don't really know how they fit together, and they don't know what the future is going to look like. So they're functioning out of a zombie kind of fear fugue state rather than any true knowledge about how to make a profit in the future.
John, pick up on that. If Wall Street doesn't know what it's doing, what does that say about the rest of us, man?
I think it's a real problem. Wall Street in general is they lack the sort of vision of the future that they used to have. They used to think that they understood what was going to happen. 2008 changed that very dramatically in almost everybody. And then we've seen since then a couple instances where they had to be reminded, so the J.P. Morgan whale experience, where they were like, right, we still don't really know how this world works.
You know, this is so interesting because I sort of figured that you guys would give some version of, you know, it hasn't much changed. They're still taking a lot of risks. They're still out there. Masters of the universe, Heidi, you know?
Well, I mean, delusion is a powerful thing, right? And so that's basically what that is. It's true that they're taking risk, but what hasn't changed is, you know, if we want to find the thing that hasn't changed, they still don't know how to understand risk. The spout is either completely on, you know, they're taking risk on everything, they're giving out bad mortgages, or it's totally off. They're not lending at all. So it shows that they don't know what the middle ground is.
John, go ahead.
Oh, I think that what the arrogance that was there beforehand, that we've had a bit of return of that, but it's nowhere near what it was in 2007. These guys really do now at least know that it's possible for them to fail. Yeah. And this was something that they really, you know, it hadn't happened in generations. And so it had gone away. They thought they had mastered capitalism. And now they know that markets are much more complex than they realize.
Can I compare it to one thing really quickly?
Of course.
It's like the show Mad Men, you know, where they have all those three martini lunches and they think they're in charge of the whole world. And then they don't really understand that the ground is shifting beneath their feet, that they're becoming dinosaurs, that the world is leaving them behind, becoming faster, smarter, colder, and far more efficient without them. And that's where Wall Street is. It's in that Mad Men era where it still thinks the good times are coming back and they're not.
Yeah, but you know, having the advertising industry try to figure that out and then having global capitalism try to figure that out are two totally different things, right?
It is very different. And one thing I do think that has changed very much for the better is that we now have regulators far more actively involved in looking at what the banks are doing. We have these, you know, these tests. We talk about the stress tests.
Yeah.
But where the Fed is really sitting down and making these guys explain what their bigger business plan is, how they're going to use the money that they take, whether they're going, you know, to strengthen their own institution, to pay shareholders, to pay themselves. That's good. We didn't have anything like that in 2008. And that was one of the big problems, is that when you had a problem like Lehman Brothers, you had the Treasury Secretary and the Fed come in and say, like, show us what you got.
Yeah.
And Dick Fuld would be like, you know, I'm not really sure. You guys can help take a look through the books if you want.
See, do you think we've come far? Because I don't think we have.
All right. Well, hang on a minute, because we got like half a minute left. And I want to get to you, right? Because we don't have time for that conversation. That cut that we played in the open of Henry Paulson saying, I didn't say we were going to be OK. Do you guys quickly remember, John, you go first. Do you think we're going to be OK?
Yeah, I do. I think we are past the stage of, you know, of Wall Street self-immolation. The world is not going to burn down.
All right. Heidi?
I think we're okay for now, but pretty soon again, we won't be.
Heidi Moore from The Guardian, John Carney from CNBC in New York. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. Moving on, the worst-kept secret on Wall Street became public yesterday. Twitter is, in fact, going to go public. But it's going to be a stock offering with an unusual amount of secrecy, delayed access to the company's books to start with. Marketplace's Queen of Kim explains the provisions of something known as the Jobs Act.
If Twitter had taken the traditional path to filing its IPO, right now we'd be flipping through hundreds of pages of documents detailing its business. But instead,
we don't know how much revenue Twitter earns. We don't know how much profit they earn. We don't know how much money they've spent. We don't know what their plans are for the future.
Steve Diamond is a professor at Santa Clara University School of Law. He says the idea behind the confidentiality rule is to smooth out the IPO process for emerging companies and let them work out some of the kinks before pulling back the curtain. Take Facebook, which took the traditional road to its IPO. It had to disclose that it wasn't really making any money on mobile, and it wasn't sure it could.
Their business model was running into problems.
And that, along with a lot of other problems, made Facebook's IPO really rocky. But Diamond says that may not be enough reason to move towards less transparency. Nate Elliott is an analyst at Forrester. He says it's assumed that Twitter's making money, but investors want to know how it's going to grow.
They have one primary line of business at this point, which is promoted tweets.
Twitter charges companies to take their tweets and direct them to a bigger audience. And the word is that audience may not be expanding as fast as it should be. But those numbers? That's right. We haven't seen them either. In San Francisco, I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, up arrows to end the week. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was news out of Tokyo early this morning that gave the markets a bit of a start. The Japanese business paper Nikkei said President Obama is set to nominate Larry Summers to run the Federal Reserve, and he's going to do it soon, too. The White House shot that down in short order. It said flat out the report was wrong, but Summers is widely believed to be on the very, very short list to replace Ben Bernanke when his term is up next January. The other name on that list, there's only two names, that's how short the list is the current vice chair, Janet Yellen. We told you about her a month or two ago. So today, a closer look at Mr. Summers from Marketplace's David Gura.
Larry Summers is a lightning rod. Critics have lined up questioning his policies and personality. Several senators on both sides of the aisle say they would not support his nomination. This is a nerdy but consequential fight and an unusually public one that seems ready-made for cable news.
Today, front page of the Journal, front page of the New York Times, saying that Larry Summers cannot get approved.
A loud voice in the chorus of critics is Larry Kotlikoff. He's an economist at Boston University who went to grad school with Summers. They've written papers together.
There are hundreds, if not thousands, of top economists in this country, in the world. We could have any one of them be the Fed chairman. I think most of them would do a better job.
Kotlikoff says the Fed chairman's job requires a certain amount of diplomacy.
You have to get everybody to agree on what the course of policy should be. And Larry Summers, unfortunately, has a track record of getting into fights with people.
Summers was on the MIT debate team. He's known for picking apart arguments and for playing devil's advocate. That's rubbed some people the wrong way, but Summers' supporters say his critics have him all wrong. They describe him as funny, as someone who, as one colleague put it, has people in stitches all the time, often in pointing out the absurdity of various arguments. Jeremy Bulow teaches economics at Stanford. He and Summers also met when they were grad students. Bulow says Summers is blind to status.
Larry's not a good yes man.
Summers doesn't care if you're a college freshman, Bulow says, or if you're the president of the United States. All Summers cares about is what you think. And to be sure, he's going to tell you what he thinks. Bulow says Summers has been a mentor to many young economists, something he traces back to graduate school when Summers worked on a research project in Indonesia.
When he came back from that summer, I asked him, well, what did you learn? And he said, you know, what I learned was that you can get a lot done in this world if you don't insist on taking the credit.
Bulow describes Summers as a brilliant economist with wide-ranging interests in policy.
He has this exceptional ability to see through the mathematics and understand the real pragmatic effects of a policy on the average person.
That brought Summers to Washington when he was young, and it's kept him coming back. Several decades ago, MIT economist James Poterba was Summers' research assistant.
One of Larry's bits of advice to graduate students beginning their economics careers was, you know, be about the economy, not about the economics literature.
But critics like Kotlikoff say that while Summers' resume and list of publications is impressive, there are red flags. Summers has made millions as a consultant to banks and hedge funds. And during the Clinton administration, he pushed for deregulating the derivatives market. That's led to questions about how he'd implement parts of the Dodd-Frank financial reform law. Former Assistant Treasury Secretary Michael Barr worked with Summers on that law, and he rejects those concerns.
He's been a strong proponent of tough reform in the sector, and I'm confident that he would implement that with the same spirit.
Another former Assistant Treasury Secretary, Ted Truman, who's friends with Summers and Janet Yellen, says some people might be surprised to hear that Summers was a loyal boss. They might assume he's so smart that, as Truman puts it, Summers brushes all the crumbs off the table.
But I think many of us crumbs who've been on the table have felt considerable satisfaction from having had the opportunity to work with him. He's always been generous to most of us.
Even if, Truman says, he can also be frustrating to work with. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The temptation, as we look back on the legacy of Lehman Brothers, is to make it all business. Banks and housing, jobs and unemployment. But the crisis and the Great Recession that followed were systemic. They reached into everything. And so they showed up in pop culture, too, which is also a business. Sally Herships takes a look at the crisis and the creative class.
For a very few people, the financial crisis was an opportunity. Jake Seligman hoped he'd be a winner. He's a veteran composer for TV, and 20 years ago, he co-wrote a musical about a bank that loves to foreclose on people.
We were just thinking of what's the worst thing in business. And it turns out that the worst thing in business is exactly what was going on.
The housing bust. So when the crisis hit, he started shopping his play around. It's called The Bank Bank, and here's how Seligman describes the lyrics in the bank song.
They're devilish. Like, it begins with, I'll take your monthly payments until they all begin to bounce. I'll take a look at your savings. I'll play with your account.
I'll do my best to call. Support. Don't think that I am insincere when I take your butt to court.
It took 2 years to get anyone interested, but after a short run at a New York theater festival, it was curtains.
Yeah, the discouragement was pretty severe, and then I just needed to make money.
So Seligman put The Big Bank aside. But pop culture has the financial crisis covered. Everything from a Dave Eggers novel to movies like Margin Call to a smartphone game called Fat Cats. And yet there's still no one iconic work. Why not? The Great Depression has The Grapes of Wrath and It's a Wonderful Life. Even the debate about the gold standard from the 1890s found an outlet in culture.
You're off to see the wizard, the wonderful wizard of Oz. It may be too soon for people to enjoy this crisis because they're still experiencing it to some extent.
How do you enjoy a crisis?
Richard Zilla teaches financial history at NYU's Stern School of Business. He says you could potentially enjoy a crisis through books, movies, and art, but not while your 401k is struggling.
One characteristic of this crisis is taking us a hell of a long time to get out of it.
Consumers need time, and so do critics.
We often don't notice these great works of art, you know, at the time.
Dwight Garner is a book critic with the New York Times.
If you look at something like the book Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, which featured Walker Evans's photographs and was about the Depression, it sold 600 copies when it first came out.
Garner says it wasn't until the 1960s that the book was seen as an icon of the Depression. It's possible Breaking Bad, the TV show about the teacher with cancer who sells meth to pay his medical bills, could also one day be seen as a classic of this era. Or Up in the Air, that George Clooney movie where he flies around the country laying everyone off until, well, it's his turn. And as for composer Jake Seligman, he's hoping it's his turn for a happy ending. He's shopping his show around again.
We repossess, we take the things you used to call your own.
In the meantime, he's selling real estate. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up.
She has certainly waited long enough. She's so synonymous with shoes, it makes perfect sense for her to have her name on a shoe line.
SJP and SHOES. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 75 points this Friday. That's a 0.5%, ended at 15,376. The NASDAQ gained 6 points, 0.2%, settled at 3722. The S&P 500 bumped up 4 points. 0.25%, finished at 1687. For the week, the Dow up 3%. The NASDAQ climbed 1.7%. The S&P put on 2%. United Natural Foods scooped up 13% today. That company supplies Clif Bars, Pirate Booty Popcorn, which isn't really popcorn, come on, Puffin Cereal, and other products to your local stores. The beauty and cosmetics retailer Ulta Salon poofed up 17% today after reporting earnings that were simply fabulous. Bond prices, well, they rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note dipped to 2.89%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. It's the fifth anniversary of AIG's $85 billion bailout. Britney Spears releases a new song, and there's a Marketplace angle. It's got the word work in the title. Also on this day, back in 1908, William Durant founded the auto company General Motors in Flint, Michigan. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
Stocks all around the world are tanking.
Lehman Brothers had 26,000 some odd employees. And
somehow we just missed that home prices don't go up forever.
Crisis.
When you think about how things played out 5 years ago this weekend, when you think about who was doing what and what was being done, there were really three people making most of the decisions. Ben Bernanke at the Federal Reserve, Tim Geithner, then the president of the New York Fed, and Hank Paulson, Secretary of the Treasury. Mr. Paulson's been out and about quite a bit this week, including now here. Mr. Secretary, it's good to have you with us.
Kai, it's good to be with you.
There's a question I want to ask to kind of tee things up here. And it's based on what you guys did, what you wound up doing 5 years ago. Are we setting ourselves up for another crisis?
Well, we made some very hard choices. We did some unpopular things. We did some things that were distasteful, you know, even to ourselves. We made plenty of mistakes. I remain very convinced that overall we did the right things to avoid catastrophe. But I'm more focused on some of the other areas that aren't getting the attention they deserve, which gets us to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Combined, they were 9 times larger than Lehman Brothers. They were the vehicle that provided mortgage insurance, so we had mortgage financing during those last 5 years. Can you imagine where housing prices might have been and how many foreclosures we would have had if we hadn't done this?
But Mr. Secretary, I'm
getting to your point.
Okay.
But it never dawned on me when we did this that they would still be in the current form they are today.
Exactly. And here we are 5 years later. You've got Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac still where they are. Congress, while having passed Dodd-Frank, can't seem to agree on how further to regulate things. The regulation writers inside Dodd-Frank have done, what, 30 or 40% of the rules. If you're an average American looking at where we are today, how can you possibly feel safer that the next time there's a crisis, and you say it's a certainty there will be one, how can you say we're going to be okay?
Well, I'm not saying we're going to be okay. The reason why 5 years after the crisis that I decided to come out and reissue my book is I don't want us to lose our sense of urgency, and we need to move ahead and get some of these important things done.
Well, let me ask you about that. You sat down with Bloomberg Business Week for a documentary that's going to come out on Monday. It's called Hank, 5 Years from the Brink, and I watched it last night. It is amazingly interesting, both just historically to relive that and think about what was going on. But you come off in that film as so likable and deeply invested in the outcome of what you were doing. And then you contrast that with the way you came off in public 5 years ago. And I have to ask, where was the guy who actually cared about what was going on?
Well, Kai, I worked around the clock. I couldn't have tried any harder.
I'm not doubting that you didn't try.
My question is, because
you have said repeatedly one of your biggest regrets is that you didn't convince the American people that the TARP and the bailout and all of this stuff was not for Wall Street but for the banks. And
right.
I wonder, looking back now, if you had just let yourself through a little bit, whether you'd have done you'd have had better success.
Yeah, I very well may have. As you said, that was my biggest regret, that we were never able to, I was never able to convince the American people that this wasn't for Wall Street. I think it's a hard sale to make because when I had to calibrate my communication during the crisis, at a time when the public wanted those that had made the mistakes to be held accountable, and I could clearly understand that. But I think those would have been at odds with market stability. Huh. And it was pretty hard to punish and save the banks at the same time.
We have a truck driver we talk to out in Iowa and Minnesota. He delivers to hardware stores out there. His name is Don Holshue. And every time I talk to him, I ask him some question of, you know, how he thinks Washington and policymakers are thinking about him. And he, to this day, gets angry when I talk to him about the bailout and Wall Street and all of that stuff, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And in some ways, that isn't all bad, you know? In many ways, it wouldn't be good if the public got used to bailouts, got used to these rescues, because we don't want to have rescues like the ones we did.
Do you think, Mr. Secretary, that we wasted this crisis?
I do not believe that, but if I was certain that we hadn't wasted it, I wouldn't have written a prologue and reissued on the Brink, and I certainly wouldn't have taken the time on the documentary. But I am concerned that we seem to have lost some of the urgency. It's an embarrassment.
Mr. Secretary, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you, Kai.
That Bloomberg documentary I was talking about, it's available on Monday on Netflix. Check it out. It's pretty interesting. This won't come as a surprise to regular listeners of this program, but when it comes to women's shoes, I don't always know my Payless from my Manolos. But this I do know. When Sarah Jessica Parker of Sex and the City fame puts out a line of shoes, it's a BFD, man. Big fashion deal. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
Oh, my God!
Shh, Harry.
Do you know what these are?
They're Sarah Jessica Parker shoes.
I thought these were an urban shoe myth.
Myth no more.
The star, perhaps the person in the world most associated with envy-worthy high heels, is releasing a line of high-end shoes at Nordstrom, responding, no doubt, to that overlooked social value.
A woman's right to shoes.
Jen Drexler is a retail analyst at Insight Strategy Group.
She has certainly waited long enough. She's so synonymous with shoes, it makes perfect sense for her to have her name on a shoe line.
Sarah Jessica Parker's teamed up with Manolo Blahnik, Carrie's shoe of choice. But the shoes themselves are not all what you might be imagining.
When I think about the shoes that she's going to launch, like a suede flip-flop as her gateway shoe.
Yep, a gateway flip-flop that'll likely cost more than $100.
That is so opposite of a Carrie shoe. Carrie never would have worn a flip-flop.
The horror. Candace Corlett is with WSL Strategic Retail. She thinks there will be buyers for Sarah Jessica Parker branded shoes.
You look at her and your eyes get wider and your mouth opens a little and it's a wow, look at that. She's a wow dresser.
But she agrees they might reconsider those flip-flops, maybe make them a gift with purchase for when you just can't walk another step in those 5-inch heels. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today just to remind us that even though it is 5 years after Lehman Brothers, the financial crisis was A, global, and B, lasting. Greece, as you know, has been through the ringer. 2 European Union and IMF bailouts, austerity budgets as far as the eye can see. Which gets us to this today from Reuters. The government in Athens has scrapped a 24-year-old perk enjoyed by public sector workers there. 6 extra paid days off a year if your job involves sitting in front of a computer more than 5 hours a day, which, now that I think of it, is my job. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. The Dow, rather, up 75 points today, about 0.5%. The Nasdaq gained 6 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 up 4 points, 0.25%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. We'll see you on Monday, everybody. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.